Welcome to the Hidden History Happy Hour podcast with Alex Dean and Brian Cunningham. Here we have a drink, have a laugh, and you just might learn something about our favorite stories from history.
Please visit our website at hiddenhistoryhappyhour.com and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you like the show, please rate us 5 stars and leave a review. Cheers.
Hey, it's us again, the Hidden History Happy Hour. Welcome, everybody. Alex, great to see you. How are you,
sir? How are you, my friend? I'm good. Yourself?
I'm great. I am not in my usual surroundings. We're roughing it on the rugged Oregon coast of the United States, where they have endless beaches that our dogs are running on. And I'm celebrating the occasion with a very nice red blend from a great California vineyard, Denner, California. This is actually called Dirt Worshipper.
Do you know what the grapes are in that?
I can tell you, yeah. This would be 88% Syrah, 1% Viognier, which is super interesting, 4% Graziano, and 7% Petit Verdot.
Well, Petit Verdot is a small, thick-skinned grape, and is very often used in that kind of percentage to give flavor. 4 or 5%. I had a team member who used to work for me. I referred to as a petit verdot. You wouldn't want too much of it, but really add something to the team. But you get the occasional full bottle of petit verdot, and it's almost always made by a really good maker because it's not a normal thing. It's quite a challenging. And so I've enjoyed some unusual and unexpected great bottles of straight petit verdot. And from your blend, I'll give you one more wine fact, which is that in the New World, unlike what you just said, normally people call that grape Shiraz, and in the Old World they call it Syrah. Same grape. A lot of people seem not to know that in South Africa, and it seems now in parts of the United States, from what you're saying, people call it a Shiraz or Syrah, depending on what style they're trying to go for. If they're trying to have a more oldie worldy traditional variety of that varietal, they call it Syrah. And if they're looking for a more brash, punchy, straightforward taste, you get a Shiraz. I like both, but I'm not particularly expressing a preference. But I think it's really interesting that the South Africans sort of semi-explicitly in their industry, half will say Shiraz and half will say Syrah.
So it's a winemaking and also a marketing decision.
Yeah, 100%.
Speaking of that, and now that I can show people who are watching as opposed to listening, I have an orca on my wine glass because that's what they have here at the Airbnb. Alex, do you know the original name of one of the most popular seafood dishes in the world, the Chilean sea bass?
Oh, yes, I do. It was rebranded, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
You've put me on the spot, and I'm not going to remember what. I think in Britain we may still call it this, but I can't remember what the fish is. What is it?
It was the Patagonian toothfish.
Toothfish. Yeah.
No one ever ordered. And then they hired some fancy company and they called it Chilean sea bass. And now the rest is,
extremely
as we say,
successful.
History.
Yeah. I lament the loss of the word Patagonian because I'm quite a Chatwin fan and I like that part of it. Anyway, very good. I'm drinking a Primus from Hacht. Which is a tremendous brewery. And should we get onto it, I've got a Tongolo lined up next, also from Hacht. Very often it was being selected as the world's best beer at a couple of different points.
Well, you're more of a man of the people than I am drinking
That's
your beer.
That's always been the case.
Speaking of that, how are your prospective constituents? How are you finding the arena, my friend?
Thank you very much. I am really enjoying getting out and about in the patch. It's a privilege to be selected by a political party as a candidate.
Yes, sir.
And
cheers.
It's very interesting. Thank you very much. Cheers. And it gives you the kind of imprimatur and permission to go and bother people and talk to them. And if you either like that or you don't, and if you don't like it, you probably shouldn't go into politics. But I do like it. I like going and talking to people about what's going on in their lives and what concerns they have. And I've had a couple of people come up in the street and say, thanks for saying this about this topic. And it's a privilege. So I'm thoroughly enjoying it. I've yet to have a voter say to me that I'm a fan of the Hidden History Happy Hour. So if that's you and you're officially in Golders Green, come and find me.
That's because the Hidden History Happy Hour lapel pin is not yet available. That's why you haven't heard that.
We'll have to fix that along with the rest of the merchandise.
So every politician worth their salt will say, I love being among the people. I get so much energy and great ideas from them. And I'm curious if you've heard some ideas that perhaps did not occur to you before you were doing your politicking.
That's a great question, and
Good
I think,
or bad, good or bad.
sure. It's a great question. A lot of the politics in the patch has been about what's happening in the Middle East, and
Yeah.
there have been some views expressed I agree with, some views I disagree with, nothing that has surprised me yet. So
Yeah.
people strong views all around, but not takes that I had frankly expected, very much expected to hear. And a good chunk of the conversation too is about crime and law and order on the streets, and that's no surprise too. The big thing that has really fascinated me is developments. There's a new development in my patch called Brent Cross West. It's the
Yeah.
first railway station in London in 20 years. It's basically a new town in London, and that is just brimming with ideas about how shared space is used. And yeah, I've always thought I knew something about that, but it turns out oh God, I'm in the foothills of learning about the possibilities of what people can do in that kind of space. So that's exciting.
Yeah, interesting. And fans, we have a great Kraken story about a castle coming up in a minute, but I just wanted to mention one thing from my honeymoon, which I just finished a couple of weeks ago. And that is, Alex, we spent a lot of time in Rio de Janeiro, and we spent a lot of time actually exploring the favelas there. And these are very well known internationally, usually sort of painted in a negative light because there's a lot of poverty in them. But one of the things I learned, one, there's amazing art that's being made in these favelas, mosaics and music, and it's really quite a vibrant experience. But also, I learned how they developed. So, the way they developed is when a new part of the Rio de Janeiro area, and I assume this is similar to other parts of the world, were being built, like when they did the Olympics in 2016, or when they would create a new shopping mall area, and they knew it was going to become a destination, you'd have to have hundreds or thousands of skilled and unskilled laborers come in to build the physical plant, the buildings, the power structure. And most of the time, at least in Brazil, these people would come from more rural areas. And so these communities, these favelas grew up because they would come and have to work somewhere and have to live somewhere they worked. Then their family would come, and then their family would come, and then their ethnic, brethren and sisters would come. And that's how these communities grew up, which probably, just because I'm from a small town, shouldn't be a revelation, but it was.
So we have those communities in London, of course, quite famously. We have a Chinatown and so forth. In my patch in Vigilis Golders Green, there's different religious communities clustered in different areas. But also right across the country, we have what we call railway cottages or rail workers' cottages. And there's a really interesting row of those in the constituency I'm campaigning in. And those, for as the name suggests, railway workers who would commutes the wrong term exactly. We just walked to the station they were going to be working at or from, or they were building the railways. Those are still with us. We have one of the most mature railway networks in the world, which comes with all sorts of issues, upgrading's really hard and so forth, and a lot of some antiquated issues that you don't get if you start afresh. But the cottages from all that time ago when the network started to be developed are like prized homes now. They're prized possessions. They started as humble places, and now they're really very attractive. So there's a tie-in there with your Rio point. Rio, of course, not being the capital of Brazil, that's one of the most commonly incorrectly given answers in pub quizzes in the world, and I tell a story about that in the first book.
And we've told that story, and I will tell you, I told that story when I was in Brazil. And I
Ah.
got schooled because I got it slightly wrong, according to the Brazilians. Everyone there who you talk to knows about the story that you wrote and we told about the son of the king that comes over and they establish the capital of Portugal and Brazil. And then the father goes back. And the way I told the story, which apparently is very incorrect, is the son who stayed made war on his father's reign. And they say, no, that's not at all what it was. It was just a little family squabble and we
Yeah,
settled it
it
amiably.
wasn't war. He sort of declared independence. But to the extent to which I got that wrong and misled you, let's brush over it and carry on.
I think it was me. Now listen, I want to quote this is going way back in the Wayback Machine, and welcome to all of our fans from Twitter and X and all of Alex's future constituents and everyone who's joining us new. Thank you so much for all of that. I wanted to mention a quote from Colonel Sherman Potter from TV's MASH. So we're definitely going into the Wayback Machine. And Colonel Potter, portrayed by the great Harry Morgan, once said that his favorite types of films are Westerns. And for a good Western, you need three things. You need horses, you need cowboys, and you need horses. And I feel, to paraphrase Colonel Potter, that for a great story, for example, from More Lessons of History, you need castles, battles, and castles.
Okay.
Let's talk about the last castle, Alex.
This is the story that I titled The Last Castle, The Strangest Battle. And it is a weird battle. Itta Castle stands on a hill, which it takes its name, in Western Austria. So we are in Austria, relatively close to Germany, if you think about that fine country. And during the Second World War, after the Anschluss, obviously, the Germans turned Itta Castle into a prison. And it was in use in that capacity from April 1943. And it was formerly under the leadership of the relatively nearby concentration camp at Dachau, which obviously is one of the darkest episodes of all human history. But Itta Castle was designed for a very particular purpose. It was meant to house the highest profile people that the Nazis had imprisoned from occupied France. So therefore, in a kind of weird, unlikely mashup of the world's oddest sitcom, fellow inmates at Itta Castle were, from politics, their former French prime ministers, Edouard Daladier and Paul Reynaud, the right-wing leader from France and secretly one of the leading members of the French resistance, François Delaroque. And by the way, if French listeners are hearing and wish to correct my pronunciation, please don't. The left-wing trade union leader, Léon Jehoux, and de Gaulle's sister. I'm pretty sure I'm pronouncing de Gaulle correctly, right, at least. Marie-Agnès de Gaulle. So those are the politicos.
Well, you could just say France if you mean de Gaulle, right?
They are the same thing. Indeed. Indeed. From the military, Maxime Weygand and Maurice Gamelin, who were the former commanders-in-chief of France's fighting forces. And then, my favourite, from the world of sport, Jean Borotra, who was the winner of some 19 tennis grand slams. That's going some, you know, today's standards and then. 19 tennis grand slams in the 20s and 30s. He was the former world number one in tennis. And he's there alongside these generals and politicos. Yeah. And there were also some other nationalities, because you can't fill an entire castle prison with just celebrities. You had some other nationalities represented amongst the prisoners. And often, typical Nazi style, in the way they had hierarchies for everything, they used the other nationalities as, you know, menial tasks and people doing kind of service work around the castle. So thus it was. Twilight days of the war, 3rd of May 1945. Zonimir, and I think it's Kukovic, who was a communist resistance member from the state then known as Yugoslavia, who was working at Itta as a handyman. And he left the castle, ostensibly running an errand for the Germans, and he had with him a letter written in English. And it asked for help from any Allied unit. This is how close the war was getting by then.
Right.
Asked for help from any Allied unit that he could find. The area immediately around Itta was still held by the Germans. So he had to go some way. He had to go to Innsbruck, famously of the Golden Roof, if people know there, Austria, which was some 40 miles away. And he there found an advance group of your very own 103rd Infantry Division, some Americans. He tells them about the situation at the castle. We've got these incredibly famous people. At dawn the next day, a column of heavily armored vehicles sets out for Itta. But the Germans are still, this is May 45, they are still fighting bitterly. And a heavy German bombardment means that that column, which was very obvious, was recalled very quickly. So well before they could get anywhere near the castle. This all takes time. And of course, in that time, Zonimir has not returned to Itta. And the Germans manning that garrison obviously knew that they were losing the war. And despite the growing despair they had about that, they had until this point maintained some kind of semblance of order. And his absence is noticed. And this is the straw that breaks the camel's back, because amongst the relatively small group of guards present there, You might have thought that will trigger their resolve to find their missing prisoner and so forth, or conduct an inquiry as to whether who knew about him going.
Right.
No, no. Sebastian Wimmer, who was their commanding officer, is the prime example of the failure of discipline at this point. Yeah, as the guards say to one another, he's probably gone off and told the allies that we're here, hasn't he? And Wimmer says, well, yeah, I think that's probably right. They go, well, that's probably us done then, say his colleagues. And I think Wimmer, and of course I'm paraphrasing because these people aren't around to tell us, he's, maybe that's you done. I think I'm going to clear out. So their commanding officer promptly absconds. He just legs it.
Yeah.
And so going AWOL, Wimmer does, leaving that little garrison leaderless. There's an interesting little twist in that stage, in that story, because Eduard Weiter, who had been, his name goes down in infamy in history, he was the commandant at Dachau. Shortly before Kukovic makes his escape, Weiter goes from Dachau thinking, I'm not going to get caught with the blame for Dachau around here. I'll go to that very nice place at Itter Castle where all the celebrities are, and I'm sure I'll be safer there. He either gets absolutely hammered and kills himself, which was the account given by some other people, or he gets himself shot by a fellow SS officer who says, I'm not getting caught with you. You know, no man is an island and all that, but good riddance to bad rubbish. So this is just a sign that discipline has completely broken down at Itter. You may recall those scenes in Downfall of Germans getting drunk in the bunker. It was pretty accurate. This is what's happening at the castle. And with Wimmer gone, the SSS Death's Head unit responsible for guarding the castle leaves as well. And so there are no guards. Left to their own devices, the prisoners promptly seize control. They arm themselves with the kit that the SS has left behind. But obviously they're the most high profile targets in the entire area, the whole of Western Austria. If there are any Germans still loyal to the Nazis, and there were plenty of those roaming around doing their worst. By this point, there were lots of bands of Germans basically refusing to accept that the inevitable was coming and pursuing their own aims, but they could really do damage to the people around them if they wanted to. This is where it gets really interesting. As they didn't know whether or not their brave Yugoslavian had succeeded, the former inmates send another chap, get on your bike, they send another guy, a Czechoslovakian. You'll note the French aristos don't do any of the legwork themselves. This very brave guy, Andreas Krabot, who volunteers, a Czechoslovakian cook, and they press gang him into this. Get on your bike and cycle
but
around.
But he does have an easier gig than the first guy.
Yeah, true. But still, you'll note the French are sitting back
French
and saying,
aren't doing it.
Someone else
yeah.
go do that. So Krabot goes on his bike to cycle around the nearest towns to find the resistance and tell them, hey, we've got the castle now. And he goes to this town called Vogel. And the remains of this Wehrmacht unit is hanging out there. This, yeah, discipline's broken down, but there's some German army units left. And this guy, Major Joseph Gangl, is there. And he had ignored the order to retreat and defend the fatherland. And bizarrely and wonderfully, this unit of the Wehrmacht had signed up with the local resistance. So Krabot gets to this village and thinks, oh, bloody hell, these Germans are still here. And they say, no, no, quite the contrary. We are Germans, but we're some nice Germans. We're on your side. We are now going to fight for your side. And so that Wehrmacht unit had planned to stay in the village and defend it against the SS until the Allies arrived. But things are moving fast, and they say, well, here's this guy on his bike. If the Americans can't get to Itter, you know, people can hear this column being bombarded and say, well, why don't we head towards the castle and we'll surrender to the Americans on the way? That'll be more convenient for everybody. And there's a unit of the Americans, 23rd Tank Battalion, is nearby. Gangl finds them, and they discuss the situation. And so, yes, there's two options, really. Option one is, I just surrender to you. Option two is, you let me and my fighting men stay a fighting unit. We team up in an unlikely mid-story twist, and we go and defend the castle together. And the Americans say, sold. Option B, let's go. They form a new column, and Americans and the Wehrmacht march together on Itter Castle.
Okay, I have to ask, are the Wehrmacht officers wearing their Nazi uniforms?
I mean, they may have adopted them, but these are the clothes they've got, right? I mean, they may have put new signs on themselves, but I'm pretty sure these are guys in the gray of the Wehrmacht marching
I'm just trying to
alongside the
imagine
Americans.
seeing this
Yeah.
combined force coming at you.
What the hell is this?
The weirdest game of Stratego ever.
Yeah. So the Americans call back, and I'm sure the headquarters says, I'm sorry, you said what? Right. But they explain what's happened. They set off heavily armed. And they acquire some supporting infantry on the way. It's like one of those, I suppose, like Lord of the Rings or whatever. The quest acquires more supporters. But there's a bridge on the way that is too weak to take the tanks. So they look just like the column did, like they are very well prepared to defend at a castle. And then just at the last minute in the movie, as you hit the third reel and you think, you know, the cavalry ain't coming, it can't get there. So Captain Lee, who was commanding the 23rd Tank Battalion, he goes on with a mere 14 American soldiers and Gangel and a dozen of his men. So, you know, we've got 26 armed guys now. All of the big columns have failed, and we wound up with a plucky small band of, I'm going to say his brothers, but actually it's a bunch of Wehrmacht who fought the entire war to 1945.
Who have never Americans. Trained with each other and probably Correct. Don't speak the same language.
Correct. They are stopped at a roadblock by the SS, and the two combined teams, there's not very many of them, wipe out the SS at the roadblock. They're like, well, you know, we've had our training wheels. Job done, guys. This seems to be working. So they push on. They get to Itter, and they find, weirder still, that the friendly Germans on the side of the Americans in this new gang are matched by a friendly German at the castle as well. The French had sought out, this is the one bit thing that the French did do, they went and found their local SS officer, a guy called Schrader, and they said, we knew you when you were sick in the castle, and we looked after you in the infirmary, and you were a good guy to us. Why don't you, we're pretty sure we're going to get attacked. Kurt Siegfried, despite your background in the SS, wouldn't you like to coordinate our defense of the castle? And he says, yes. So now we've got, this is how extraordinarily the German discipline had broken down by this point. A defecting group of Wehrmacht meet a defecting SS officer at the castle to defend the castle together. And the castle residents say, you know, super you chaps are all here, lovely. But there ain't many of you. And we are simply so high profile that plainly the Führer will not tolerate us being free for a moment. You might think, by the way, the conspicuousness of them might not have been helped by the French occupants of the castle flying the tricolore from the top of the castle, the highest point visible for miles around them. So they're kind of advertising their presence. But anyway, yeah, those fanatically loyal to the Führer are bound to come and take us on. By the way, of course, unbeknownst to him, the Führer by this point has killed himself in his bunker. But you know, they are sure to come to seek justice upon us because we're just so prominent. What should we do? You can imagine the powwow that's taking place. You've got this junior SS, relatively junior SS officer. You've got an outright junior Wehrmacht officer, and you've got a junior American officer. They sit down with two former French prime ministers. They sit down with former French military marshals of the armed forces, and they discuss.
Don't forget the tennis star.
And world number one, 19 Grand Slam winning tennis star, to discuss how they're going to defend this castle. And Gangel says, well, look, if you're not going to get reinforcements here, why don't we go and ask the Austrian resistance for help? That would help us. And, you know, I'd left Gangel had a big unit back in this town. He left most of them there. Why don't we send back for more guys? So he rings them up. The phone system's still working to agree. He rings them up. He says, you've got to send us reinforcements. And they do. They get three more guns. They get three more people. They get two people from his unit, and they get one Austrian resistance fighter still in his teens. And the Austrian resistance says, look, guys, we've got problems of our own. Looks a bit like you've made your own problem, really. But we're fighting the Germans here, and half of you are German anyway. You carry on doing your thing. We're going to defend our patch. So in the absence of greater assistance, Lee, the American captain, arranges his miniature army in defense positions around the castle. He's got one tank, a Sherman tank, which they christened Besotten Jenny, and they plop that at the castle gate. Fans of Warhammer, that is, of course, where you would put your main asset, right in the most obvious and immediate place. And he tries to order his unbelievably high-profile French prisoners, with whom he was suddenly burdened, to hide inside. To which they said, "Well, thank you very much, young man, for your recommendations. But yeah, we think we've got a bit more authority about this world than you have. We've waited for freedom a very long time. And to their credit, we're going to fight for it." And he didn't really have the rank to insist on getting his way. Thus it was that some of the most senior Frenchmen of the 1940s fought one of the last battles of World War II alongside tiny contingents of American and Wehrmacht soldiers. Because as predicted, one of these roaming SS groups still trying to enforce the Führer's will attacks them soon enough. Now, there weren't that many of these guys either, but 150 battle-hardened SS fanatics still going at it, you know, in late May 1945, in early May 1945. This is, you know, these guys know what they're about, and what they're about is inflicting harm very ruthlessly and efficiently. So you would have thought there were more than enough of them to get their objectives done. And for the duration of what must have been an awful, long, hard night, Castle Itter's impromptu defences are probed and probed and probed by these SS men, taking pot shots, advancing and retreating, sussing out how many of them there are there, not many, before they can get in and, one assumes, wipe out the prisoners that are no longer imprisoned. Real attack commences at dawn, as always in the movies, at dawn on the 5th of May. Bissot and Jenny is the only main machine gun fire for the defenders and is then destroyed by the SS. Miraculously, no casualties as the tank explodes. Allies and friendly Germans, nice Germans, all escape, no problem. And Lee knew that backup was eventually going to come from his own unit that he'd had to abandon.
Yeah, Lee is the American captain.
Correct. Yeah. So, but he knows that things are getting harder fast, and he fears they're all going to be killed before the relief can arrive. Now our tennis pro comes to the fore. Barotra volunteers to jump over the castle wall and run through the encircling enemy. Of course, you don't know where they are. They're not polite enough to hold up signs. He's just going to find a way through the enemy line around the castle, the most high profile and obvious thing in the neighborhood. You're going to escape the castle and run to tell the Americans that they're in trouble. It's a ridiculous plan, which worked. Jump successfully, run successfully, finds the Americans successfully. And of course, the Americans are like, "Who the hell is this guy? Yeah, he's just
a French tennis guy."
Well, he's French, and maybe, I don't know who. But how's this for the media to the rescue? There was a French Canadian reporter, René Levesque, and who, by the way, went on to become Premier of Quebec. Everyone in this story is incredibly prominent, right?
Sure.
And René was a reporter embedded with the American military. And he recognized Barotra because he'd reported on Grand Slams. He's like, "I know that guy. He's for real. If he tells you they're all holed up in this castle, they really are holed up in this castle."
Well, because obviously being a tennis star means your veracity can't be questioned.
Well, I suppose the Americans are confronted with this guy saying, "Listen, you're going to find this hard to believe, but I've just been holed up with the past two French prime ministers, the de Gaulle's sister, the leaders of the French army. A bunch of Germans are fighting with us, and we're under siege from the SS." And they're like, "Yeah, pull the other one. It's got bells on." And their reporter says, "No, he really is the French tennis star. That's why he was in prison then." So the Americans say, "Okay, well, what do you want us to do?" And Barotra says, "Give me an American military uniform, and then I want you to march with me to Castle Itter, where the Wehrmacht are fighting against the SS, and our former prime minister's de Gaulle's sister and a few of your lot are helping out." And the Americans, of course, say, "Very well. We will willingly suspend our disbelief.
This is a plan.
This I have to see. I'm going to come along for the ride because this we've got to see." You remember that scene where Gandalf arrives with the dawn? The 142nd American Infantry Regiment makes full speed for Itter and smashes through the besieging forces at the castle as its defenders were firing their last ammunition. Very few SS officers, soldiers survived, but those who were not killed are taken prisoner. And 2 days later, Germany unconditionally surrenders. This is one of the last battles of the entire war. It's fought by generals, prime ministers, French tennis stars, and the Wehrmacht against the SS. So, tremendously happy ending, but no conflict is without caveats and without tragedy. Gangl, the valiant Wehrmacht officer who defected and defended the castle, had been killed by an SS sniper in the course of trying to ensure and succeeding in ensuring the safety of former French Prime Minister Paul Reynaud. He was, how about this, the castle's only casualty. They lost one man in the course of this pitched battle. And today, in Virgil, the town that he'd left to go and defend the castle in Virgil, a street is named after him. I mean, it's a hell of a thing, really. You know, he was going to defend the town village against the SS, and instead he goes to defend the castle and he dies. And for his part, our American captain receives the Distinguished Service Cross. I'll give you one really pleasing postscript. Brotre lived until 1994, aged 95. And in his name, at Wimbledon, which is, of course, the best and most important tennis tournament in the world, here in my country, it's definitely the most important, Brian. The John Brotre Sportsmanship Award is given annually at Wimbledon. And the reason people may not know about it is that the ceremony is entirely private. The ceremony happens in private during the championships to a player who is judged by the organisers to have shown outstanding sportsmanship throughout his or her career. That is to say, who has lived the good life within the sport, as Brotre so clearly did. And you get one a year, and I think the fact that people don't really even know publicly, it's not hugely discussed, many people won't know that award even exists, I think is great testament to Brotre and the story. But what a weird story, right? Wehrmacht against the SS is one of the last battles of the entire Second World War.
Well, so much to say about that. But my immediate reaction is I'm pretty sure McEnroe and Djokovic are not winners of that award, given in secret or not. I'm going to tell Lisa, my wife, about this because she's a huge tennis fan. So a couple things come to mind. One is, you know, in every war, there's going to be a last battle. And the more modern we get, the more communications we have, the fewer people die after the war is over. But this always happens, right? I mean, I think there was like the Battle of New Orleans in the U.S. Civil War. It was months after the South had surrendered. I might have that slightly wrong. People can write in. But these guys, of course, they didn't know how close they were to the end. A question I have, and I got a couple thoughts, but the question I have is, do we know if any of the players in our story, including the American units, were involved at all in the liberation of Dachau, which must have come pretty soon after that? And if not, we'll research it.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think that would have happened almost simultaneously with the battle at Issa Castle. And so close and proximate are those events that I don't think any of those directly involved in the battle at the castle would have been involved in the direct liberation of Dachau. But they may have, of course, gone there in that the week after, the two
helped
weeks
to expose it,
after. your broader point about these things happening in history, you know, you could argue that the last casualties in the second, people always say, of course, you die, some people die of their wounds incurred in battle years afterwards, and you can legitimately say they are deaths caused from that war. But on the island of Lubang, the Philippine villagers who were killed by Hiro Onoda because of his disbelief that Japan would have surrendered, it happened into the 70s. You know, Hiro Onoda, in his amazing book, My 30-Year War, describes how he went on fighting in the jungles of that island because he just didn't believe that the war had finished. I mean, those were still sort of casualties of war, weren't they?
Yeah. Another thing that comes to mind is, I'm sure I've told this story before on the show, but my first acquaintance with all the events of World War II, the Holocaust and everything else, was when I was, I don't know, 9 or 10 years old. I read the gigantic 1,200-page novel War and Remembrance by Herman Wouk, which I commend to everyone to read at some point in your life.
Sure.
It's a commitment, but it's very good. And there's an entire storyline. Obviously, it's a novel, it's fiction, but there's an entire storyline about a very famous German Jewish intellectual Aaron Jastrow, I believe his name was, who is imprisoned by the Nazis in a successive set of locations intended to be able to show the Red Cross and the world that these, you know, good Jews, these celebrity Jews, were being treated nicely. And I wonder if maybe that story was a little bit inspired by the castle.
Well, I think that the Germans, of course, had these very high profile prisoners, at least in part because you never know when they might be come in handy. You know, you may want to parade the former prime ministers and the former leaders of the armed forces. You may want to do a show trial. You know, you may want to use them as a bargaining chip later.
Trade them for something, yeah.
Very cheap to maintain, potentially very beneficial later. Indeed, you know, if the war's going our way, but we want the French to do something for us, maybe dangling the prospect of freedom for de Gaulle's sister might get de Gaulle to behave differently. I mean, I doubt very much the general was for turning on anything, but, you know, that's the kind of thing that the Nazis might have thought about. But of course, at the beginning of the war, the Germans treated prisoners pretty well. Uniformed prisoners.
Relatively.
Pretty well. Well, certainly compared to those who were being deported and sent to the East or summarily executed in their own countries, and gypsies and homosexuals and Jews and were being slaughtered. But you know, Allied prisoners write about the relatively civil conditions in which they were kept and received Red Cross parcels and so forth. And so all the more, because of course the Germans are thinking, well, how are our soldiers going to be treated on the other side of this exchange? I'm not suggesting the Germans were nice. There's a self-interest. And once the rules are established, then you stick to the rules. And if on the one hand, the rules say we go off and murder Jews, it turned out there were plenty of Germans who signed up to the Nazi cause and said, yeah, okay, we'll do that. And on the other hand, if the rules say that we maintain Stalag Luft 11 to these standards and we deliver the Red Cross packages on Thursdays, then we do that. And, you know, the hypocrisy never seemed to occur to them. But, you know, in that system, I think you get at its apex former heads of government and former heads of the military who you may well want to keep well. Now, these guys, as the fact they fell under the formal command of Dachau demonstrates, that the membrane between decent treatment of high profile people and the unceremonious slaughter of people going on very close to them, I mean, is almost unreal, isn't it?
Well, my whippet Oliver has something he'd like to say about this particular story, but I will speak for him since he does not have a voice. And what Oliver would be saying, if he could speak, is this echoes, and I think we're on, I don't know, episode 8 or 9 of season 2. And again, thank you so much to all of our fans, old and new. We've got thousands of views of each one of our episodes and thousands of listens. But I got to go back to our pilot episode, Alex. The story from my hometown of the cannon, Old Betsy, that was moved around the fort to defeat a much superior force of your folks.
That. Besot
and
Jenny.
I'm thinking of Besot and Jenny. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a weird echo, isn't it?
It's a lovely echo. And you mentioning the very pleasing growth in our listening and viewing figures reminds me, I'm really bad at this generally, but reminds me to ask people that have enjoyed this episode to please like and subscribe wherever you get your podcast. It really helps us out. Recommend us to your friends, if you would, please. Think about somebody who might enjoy a podcast and send a link to them. We enjoy telling these stories, and we hope you enjoy listening to them.
Absolutely, and we'll buy Oliver some extra dog food because of his participation in this episode. He's a very cheap guest. And listen, thanks so much, everyone. Great story, Alex. A cracking one, as my friends would say. And best of luck on the campaign trail. See you next time.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Hidden History Happy Hour podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you have questions, comments, or suggestions for topics, you can find us on Twitter or on our website, hiddenhistoryhappyhour.com. We look forward to joining you next time.
Much gratitude to our multi-talented production team of Jeremy Corr, Kate Cruz, and Grace Keller, and to our visionary executive producer, Ivan Williams. And thanks also to our art designer, David Wardle,
without whom this podcast would be, well, history.
Cheers.